You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Ryan Adams.
So Ryan, you're going to introduce us this week to Hamiltonian Monte Carlo, which I think has nothing to do with Lin-Manuel Miranda going to Monaco and staging his hit musical, or am I wrong?
No, it's unfortunately just a technique for markup chain Monte Carlo, but it happens to be hopefully efficient in high-dimensional problems. So Hamiltonian Monte Carlo is tackling this this very challenging situation in markup chain Monte Carlo. So to remind you, markup chain Monte Carlo, or MCMC, is about the problem of trying to compute expectations under possibly very complicated distributions for which you don't have the normalizing constant. So typically the way we do that is you make some kind of sequence of small decisions, jump from sort of one state of the Markov chain to the next, and you try to construct that Markov chain in such a way that as you run it forward, the marginal state of the chain, that is, if you kind of look at where you've landed, that converges to the distribution that you care about. And so then you can draw samples from it and compute expectations and different kinds of things under that, using those samples. And that lets you do different kinds of computation that you might want to do for say, Bayesian machine learning. The thing that's hard about MCMC is that often the kinds of techniques that you use look a lot like random walks. And random walks tend to just sort of diffuse quite slowly around on the in this distribution. And so you really depend to get good answers from MCMC on your random walk eventually wandering to kind of every place, or at least having a chance to wander to every place in the distribution and having forgotten its initial starting point. But random walks being slow and in high dimensions kind of it being very hard, this may take a very long time. And the reason it's hard in very high dimensions is because there's some unintuitive behavior that happens on high dimensional probability distributions, which is that in higher and higher dimensions, typically what we call a typical sample from a distribution becomes concentrated on a relatively thin shell. This is a little bit weird and counterintuitive because in low dimensions, if you think about something like, think about a Gaussian distribution in low dimensions, it's just a bell curve, right? It's the bell curve that we've all seen for test scores and everything sort of in the world. And it looks like this big diffuse thing that we have a pretty good intuition for. And then you can imagine generalizing that to two dimensions where it has, you know, this kind of cloud of points that's roughly elliptical. And then in higher dimensions, you can imagine that this kind of, say, this kind of spherical object, this kind of spherical cloud sort of continues to be a spherical cloud. But what you notice is that in higher and higher dimensions, the sort of density of points in this cloud, the sort of the place where all of the sort of probability mass is, starts to become concentrated on a very thin shell. And there's a variety of ways you can convince yourself of this. My favorite way is to think about the following, which is that if I had a spherical Gaussian distribution, then essentially what I'm going to be doing, if I look at the distance from the origin that I'm going to land, that I can look at the squared distance from the origin, so Euclidean distance, squared Euclidean distance, as being a sum of each of the square of each coordinate. And if I have a whole bunch of dimensions, then I'm going to be summing the squares of individual dimensions for a possibly very large number. And if all of those have some sort of known mean and known variance, then central limit theorem sort of tells me that that's going to start to concentrate very quickly. And so what that means is that distance, no matter where, sort of when I draw from the, when I draw from this high dimensional distribution, then, I'm going to wind up some very like sort of specific distance from the origin. For almost every sample I draw, now I may wind up in different places on this shell, but I'm going to wind up essentially very, very close to some characteristic distance from the origin. So I will wind up on this shell or very near the shell with high probability. And that doesn't sound like, I mean, so that's counterintuitive, but it doesn't necessarily sound like a disaster. Until you start to think about what it would mean to try to take a random walk in this kind of world where we're doing acceptances and rejections. So imagine that I'm sitting on the shell and I'm going to use an MCMC type technique, and I'm going to make a proposal and a little sort of fuzzy ball around where I am, and then try to jump to that point and look and see whether I'm in a place of sort of higher density than I am now, roughly speaking, and sort of decide whether or not I'm going to move to that point. Now, what's going to happen is if I'm on that shell, almost every place I propose is going to cause me to jump off of the shell, and I'll reject it. And so it becomes very hard to move very fast or very far once we get into higher dimensions, because almost everything I do is going to be causing me to jump off the shell. So efficient methods for sampling from a high dimensional distribution are necessarily going to need to sort of know about that shell in some way and try to constrain themselves if possible to being on the shell. And that's exactly what Hamiltonian Monte Carlo tries to do. So Hamiltonian Monte Carlo is an auxiliary variable method. What that means is that it takes all of the variables that you care about, that you're trying to sample from, and then it adds a bunch of new variables. And now you're going to sample from all of this stuff together, but hopefully with the property that if you're sort of careful with the math, that if you look at just the marginal distribution over the original stuff, then that's kept intact. So you add more things in such a way that it makes the problem easier somehow, but in a way that doesn't change the answers that you get. The kind of stuff that Hamiltonian Monte Carlo does is it adds what you can think of as pseudo-momenta. That sounds really weird, but what it literally means is that we're going to imagine this high-dimensional problem that we care about is actually a surface. And that the state of our Markov chain is now a frictionless ball. And we're going to try to create the situation where we're rolling the ball around the surface. And so then it will hopefully sort of stay, make sort of big, long trajectories that are on the that are sort of stuck on this high probability shell. Now, the state space, though, of this ball is described not just by its position, but also by its momentum. And so we add momenta to this problem that don't really exist. But the idea is that then once the sort of ball gets rolling in some direction, it can actually continue to keep rolling. And we get away from this random walk behavior while still staying on the shell. That's the idea. And we try to construct this in such a way that all of the sort of nice guarantees associated with MCMC stay intact. And so what we wind up doing is building essentially a sort of virtual Hamiltonian system that has this state space. And we then are alternating between integrating that Hamiltonian system, so simulating the ball rolling around, and then randomizing the amount of kind of energy that the ball has. So you can think of this kind of crazy way of doing Markov chain Monte Carlo, where you simulate a ball rolling around, and then you give that ball a random kick in order to make it really a random sort of, the algorithm to be ergodic and to give you correct answers. So you give it a random kick, and then you simulate the ball rolling around a little more, you give it another random kick, and so on. And the idea is that you'd take these big, long trajectories instead. And in particular, it knows about the sort of geometry of the space. So if you think about optimizing a problem, you could imagine taking a kind of a random walk and eventually getting to some good minimum, or you could imagine using gradient information and getting to the minimum much faster. Same kind of idea here, but now with MCMC. Rather than doing just kind of random stuff, we're going to look at the gradient, and we're going to try to take advantage of this additional information that we have about the structure of the problem to make longer and more efficient trajectories. The challenge, you know, there's some challenges, of course, associated with implementing Hamiltonian Monte Carlo. It's a more complicated thing to do than your vanilla Metropolis-Hastings type algorithm. You're going to need to take gradients. The good news is that we have lots of powerful automatic differentiation software. So there's a variety of tools out there that lets you just get these gradients kind of automatically once you specify the function. Tools like STAN are very nice for doing this efficiently. And then my group also has the AutoGrad package. The other thing you need to do is when you're performing this simulation, you can't just do a sort of very simple like forward Euler type integration. You have to do something a little bit more complicated because it needs to be a reversible integration. So when the ball gets to where it's going, it has to be the case that if you sort of reverse the momentum, you would come back to where you started. And that is to say that this whole sort of process needs to satisfy detailed balance. And then it also needs to be volume preserving. That is, if we have some little sort of patch of the distribution, then the sort of volume of that patch needs to be preserved by applying this this process to it. And these are sort of properties that are sort of technical properties that we need in order for us to get the right answers when we're sampling from this distribution. Fortunately, these are both satisfied by a relatively straightforward form of Euler integration called leapfrog Euler integration, where you sort of take half steps in the momenta and then update the state otherwise. So anyway, the point is that you don't need to think too hard about that aspect of things because other people have worked it out. There's this really fantastic review paper that came out, I think, in 2010 by Radford Neal that you can find online on archive, and also was in like a CRC Press handbook of Markup Chain Monte Carlo. Fantastic, absolutely fantastic paper, like all of Radford's papers on HMC. And then also David Mackay's textbook talks about this as well and has a very nice kind of algorithm box that you can just sort of plug and play. It still requires tuning. The stuff, you know, the simplicity of the algorithms kind of sweeps some of the realities under the under the rug, but it's really kind of the right thing to do in a lot of situations. Michael Betancourt has been doing a lot of really fantastic work in this lately. He gives amazing talks about this, by the way. I saw him give a talk at JSM last year or the year before about Hamiltonian Monte Carlo, and it was a beautiful talk, very clear. And so if you get the chance to watch one of his videos online about this stuff, I highly recommend it.
We'll have more about Hamiltonian Monte Carlo on our website, thetalkingmachines.com.
This week's listener question on Talking Machines is about unbalanced data. Most of the data I work with is highly unbalanced, like binary labels in ratio 1 to 20. How do you deal with that?
This is a question that comes up all the time. It's a very practical thing because lots of data are unbalanced, and so we need sort of practical ways to deal with it. I don't think there's sort of the one true way to deal with it, but I can give a couple of tips and a couple of straightforward things to try first. So the number one rule associated with unbalanced data is to make sure that you're thinking hard about how you evaluate the performance of your algorithm. I know that sounds like an obvious thing, but if you have a 20-to-1 data set and you get 95% accuracy on it, you should not be very impressed with yourself. And that's because simply predicting the most common label will give you high accuracies. So you need to be thinking about evaluating it with the knowledge that making very naive decisions might give what appears to be good accuracy. So that is to say, as always, think hard about your evaluations and compare them to simple random predictions and sort of constant predictions. So a conventional thing to do is to do something like upweight essentially the data that you have fewer of. So most algorithms that you're going to be able to that you're going to use most supervised algorithms that you use would have some way to essentially cause a datum to be worth 10 or 20 times more than it would normally. And most of the time, this just corresponds to imagining that you're sort of replicating that datum throughout your data set. And so what you're sort of trying to do is get to a place where you essentially have kind of the same weights associated with each one of these guys, the same effective number of data for each class. And then you'd hope that your algorithm is going to be a little bit better behaved because it's seeing it's not focusing so much on the sort of marginal statistics of each label. It's very important after you do that, if you're going to use something like logistic regression or whatever it is you're using, to go back in and make sure that you recalibrate the labels that you get out, because you will now be making predictions from something that thinks the world is 50-50 between these labels when it is not. And so you'll want to make sure that you do some kind of sort of calibration post-training to get back to the sort of reality of the situation. There are other things you could imagine too. You could imagine, subsampling the larger class and creating ensembles. There's various ways that you can handle this. I mean, in some models, we'll allow you to just go straight after it with it, you know, maybe don't care that much about label imbalance. But a typical kind of thing is to basically try to create some kind of artificial balancing and then compensate for it after the fact. But as I say, the number one main thing is don't fool yourself when you're evaluating the method. Because simple things like accuracy may be very misleading.
If you've got a question for Talking Machines, email us at thetalkingmachines@gmail.com or tweet us at TLKNGMCHNS. This week's guest on Talking Machines is Douglas Eck of Google. He's working on the Magenta project there. When I sat down with him at ICML this year, I asked him, how did he get where he is now?
That's a great question. I started off as a failed musician, and I've always tried to work with other failed musicians. I did my undergraduate in English Lit.
Oh, very nice.
I wanted to be a writer. And
oh, wow.
I actually, you know, creative writing has always been a sort of side passion of mine. And I graduated, and I realized, and I promise you it was actually a surprise, that there really aren't a lot of jobs for creative writing people.
My God.
I know, shocking. But I had been hacking code on the side and understanding more and more about computation and ended up working as a database programmer. And that's where my musicianship failed as well. Mm. I was playing songs in coffee houses and things like that. And I finally got bored with it and said, again, naively, I'm going to go back to work in music and computing. And I just sort of almost literally drew a Venn diagram and saw there was an intersection of music and computing.
Nice.
and started working on a PhD in cognitive science. One thing that always comes out for me is wondering whether once you do a PhD or not. And someone said, well, you know, you're going to be 6 years older in 6 years. The question is whether you want to have a PhD or not. And I don't think it's about the degree, but
yeah.
I think thinking that way, it actually was one of those things. I was ready to hear that at that time in my life. I was 24. I'm like, well, yeah, life goes on anyway. You might as well just kind of dive in and do what you know, do what you want to do. So once I finished up this PhD, I figured again I'd be unemployable. And I mean, it was like a PhD in cognitive science and computer science and focusing on the neural dynamics of coupled oscillators and how they respond, like really, really arcane, like really caring about rhythm perception. And then like this wild thing happened. I got a great postdoc working on recurrent neural networks, and B, the iPod happened.
Oh.
Right? And with the iPod came demand for audio. And
yeah.
So I kind of moved towards audio signal processing and machine learning on large audio data sets. And actually was lucky enough to work on a very hot recurrent neural network architecture called long short-term memory, LSTM. Mm. So mm-hmm. I have these papers out in like 2002 working with LSTM on music generation, which totally failed to solve any interesting problem, you know, with respect to music, but at least like put me on the map as being like an early pioneer.
Awesome.
And then I moved on to University of Montreal mm-hmm. and joined the faculty there in a group formed by Yashua Bengio, now called the Mila Lab, and was the Lisa Lab, and had the chance to really dive into deep learning and to collaborate with some really amazing people, both at University of Montreal and the Brahms Group, Brain, Music, and Sound, and also at McGill with the Kermit Group, the Center for Music Technology there, and kept going, and did what many people do that leave academia for industry. I got tenure. And if you're a competitive sort, if you're sort of a driven person, it can feel like the game is over. Like you kind of hit that level. Like, why would I keep playing this game?
Yeah.
And so when I had the chance on sabbatical to join Google, I jumped at it and haven't looked back since.
That's fantastic. So tell me about Magenta. Is that the main thing that you're working on these days?
Absolutely. So once at Google, I started working on mostly on music recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for a long time on Play Music, really since its beginning. And dove into that idea of like how can you start to connect users to the music they love,
mm-hmm.
And I think the questions become more and more about people and less about technology the closer you get to products like that, which I really enjoyed. And finally, about a year and a half ago, even before Deep Dream are these really beautiful images that are generated from neural networks by initializing them with noise and then doing some learning. Even before Deep Dream. Deep Dream is probably these beautiful images generated by neural networks. I saw that in the field of machine learning, we're absolutely moving towards caring about generative models again.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even kind of a reuniting of what we can do with neural networks and what people maybe a decade ago were trying to do with Bayesian inference,
mm-hmm.
with another framework of machine learning. And so I started asking this question, can we actually revisit this question of computational creativity? And actually, incidentally, the first internal documents I wrote at Google were kind of ranty, like, why aren't we doing this? You know, we need to do music and we need to do art, and why aren't you letting me? And I sort of realized at some point there was really no one not letting me. It was just that I was ranting, like, who's this crazy guy with this sign?
No one's holding you back, Doug.
Exactly.
Go for
like
it.
Really, just like, how about a proposal that's sane and not just you ranting? So like, I locked all those internal shared documents. No one gets to read them anymore. And I really, in a day, I rewrote a vision for Magenta, which I think still holds, which is, can computers, you know, do creative things? Can they make music and art? And if so, how?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And very, very also possible, if not, why not? Like, what else do we need in the mix? And so, we know we're talking about using the same kind of technologies that have broken, you know, state-of-the-art records in speech recognition, in audio, in image annotation, in translation. Like, what can we do with these if we start taking their generative capacity and actually trying to connect that to the arts and music?
Mm-hmm.
And if you follow that through, I think you're at actually a really interesting proposition that is, you know, at first glance, it's like, oh, great. All right. You know, let's just rewrite that is. Let's let a few people just have fun.
Right, right.
And it should be fun, right? But also, like, look, I look at my kids. I have two kids, 12 and 17 years old. And, like, they're using their phones for well over 50% media consumption, entertainment, yeah. Right? Like, why not use machine learning to help automate part of that, to sort of fan out into new possibilities with what we can do with personalized media generation and, you know, give people new tools. And I found, to my surprise, it wasn't so surprising, I guess, once I was able to state this as a valid research direction, there was absolutely no problem getting support inside of Google. And, you know, we were able to get this off the ground in Brain.
That's
and,
awesome.
And start working on it.
What are you exploring right now?
So right now we're in what I would call fan out mode, mm-hmm. exploration mode. I'll be giving a talk tomorrow that's very speculative, talking about different directions we can go in. We've just launched an open source site. We have a GitHub. It's under the organization of TensorFlow, which is by design. This is a TensorFlow linked project,
mm-hmm.
TensorFlow Magenta, and we're just starting to see the community kick in and contribute. And that's been actually really like way more fun and way more. I knew it was going to be interesting. It's taken off much more quickly than I thought.
Mm.
So we, as part of our launch, we released a recurrent neural network to write music scores. And I don't think it's breaking the state of the art, but I also think it's carefully prepared and does some nice things, a couple of clever things. And some people took one of our compositions that we had put up in MP3 format,
mm-hmm.
and they downloaded it. We don't know these people. This is a guy in Vietnam. And he played this really wild Vietnamese instrument on top of it.
Whoa.
And then someone else jumped in on the recording and played guitar. And like suddenly what was a pretty thin melody, right? Like what we liked about it is that the melody that was generated by the model did have some chord structure. You could play it as a 1-4-5 kind of a pop progression, or you could play it more as like a starting on the minor six, like an A minor thing,
yeah.
for the music geeks out there. But they actually did some cool things with it. And
that's
I realized
awesome.
Like if you can get this material out to other creative people, it may be more powerful than you might think at first glance. And by that I mean, right, we just got a lot of information from them.
Mm-hmm,
they just like added a bunch of material to this piece.
Right.
And as long as everybody's happy with us learning from each other, we can take that and learn from them what we got right and what we got wrong and close this learning loop with the world, which is what I think is sort of the hardest problem in doing machine learning in the arts and music. And the reason it's hard is that otherwise we don't know what's good. I mean,
right.
We didn't even know what's good in, you know, play music. The people doing recommendation in Spotify don't know what's good. They're
right,
just like, you
right.
know,
they're just
follow
like,
the users,
right?
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, they
yes.
like it. I'm sorry you liked that song, but I guess you do. And so I guess I feel the same way about computer-generated music and art. You know, we really aren't going to know if it's good. I mean, we lack a solid, you know, computational metric for it, aside
right,
from
right.
whether people like it or not. And so closing that loop is crucial.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. It also sounds like a highly effective wedge for creative endeavors. It would be amazing to be able to create jumping off points for collaboration and for the creativity.
I think that's right. I've gone back and forth with people about whether you want a project like Magenta to be about computers generating art, or if you want it to be about tools for artists.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally come to the conclusion, you know, why not both?
Yeah,
you know that
right.
meme, you know, it's the shrug,
right.
shrug shoulders meme. like, and I think there's like, there's a shallow answer to that is, which is, oh, we're going to pursue both in parallel. But I think the better answer to that is all of art is about personal generation and collaboration.
Yeah.
And so even if we, let's just say for the sake of argument, we're so good at this that mm-hmm. we create the next J.S. Bach.
Yeah.
You know, but he's doing something completely new, or she, let's call it she. She's doing something completely new, right?
Yeah.
Even then, what's useful about that outside the context? Not much. I'm sorry. What's useful about that outside the context of collaborating with other artists and sharing with the world? Not much. I mean, right. Everything gets pulled back into the social context. So to state that more clearly or in a less rambling fashion, we are interested in generative models that can generate great material for their own sake. And mm-hmm. we're thinking about ways to do that well with planning in the context of what's called reinforcement learning. But at the same time, we realize that to the extent that these models succeed, they're going to be used by other people, including artists, mm-hmm. but not just artists, just people.
So you also work with, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but this was my understanding of it. You helped to run a program that also like works with artists to use generative models and to use machine learning as a tool for them. Is that correct? To create new works.
That's partially correct. I would say that's half the goal of Magenta. So that program is Magenta.
Okay.
We purposely made Magenta an open source program. I'm sorry, we made Magenta an open source project, and we pulled it away from TensorFlow to have its own sandbox, its own mm-hmm. GitHub. Mm-hmm. And the reason for doing that is we actually want to invite coders that would not be submitting code to core TensorFlow, mm-hmm. including artists who want to just try to dabble a little bit. Like, I'm perfectly happy if our models directory in TensorFlow/Magenta is filled with kind of crazy attempts to do things with machine learning that, how do I put this positively, might not pass the sort of quality test of machine learning that you get in, you know, the
right.
sort of professional world of
right.
machine learning. Like, there was a, this isn't part of Magenta, but there was a person who, I mean, we can look this up and we can fill it in later, mm-hmm. but who did a blog posting using a recurrent neural network to generate jazz improvisation.
Mm.
And he did it as like a hackathon thing, but he trained on one song.
Oh.
Now, if you know machine learning, you're like, right. wait a minute, I think you probably overfit that song because you only had one data point in
right.
your training set, you know?
Right.
But at the same time, it made this really cool.
Right.
Like, and it, what it did was it more or less memorized the song.
And gave it, but did he just give you the song back or did he give
you? No, lots of variants, because even if you try to memorize something with something like a recurrent neural network, the way it works is you're doing what's called like next step prediction. So you're doing something really naive, in fact. You're saying, okay, here's how composition works. I mean, one step further. The assumption that we're making, the naive assumption that we're making with the sort of simple RNN model that we released and that we have this demo about and that we know is naive, is, okay, how does music work? Give me three notes. Okay. Now, I've got a musical score. I've seen three notes of that score. This mm-hmm. is the training process. I'm going to try to predict the fourth note.
Yeah.
Did I get it wrong? Oops, I got it wrong. Calculate some gradient.
Right.
Learn a little bit. Now let's go on to note 5 and 6 and 7 and 8. And so it's always just, given the previous notes, predict the next one.
Right.
Now that sounds pretty reasonable on paper. You show a model a few thousand or a few hundred thousand scores and it starts to learn, you know, some structure.
Mm-hmm.
But then the way that we compose with these, or the normal way to compose with these models, is to do exactly the same thing. Like, give the model some priming sequence, you know, dun, 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 something like that. Mm-hmm. That was the priming sequence we used. I've been singing it over and over in talks, so I got it down. and then let it predict the next note and feed that in as input. So
yeah.
like the model, think of it as like sort of eating its own tail. The model is generating the next note and then believing what it generated and feeding it in as input. Like, okay, so that gives you some interesting, if the model is able to handle long time scale structure, it will sort of show up in these compositions mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. it's seeing what it wrote and it's trying to remember it and it's doing the right thing. It's hopelessly like far from what the composition process is like.
Yeah.
Right? It's almost like saying, even the writing process, like nobody writes like, okay, I'm going to start with word. I'm not going to think at all about what I'm trying to say.
Right.
I just happen to generate the word hello. Okay, that's a good word. What comes next?
Probably world, right. exclamation point.
It's like writing books by using autocomplete, right?
Yes. You know?
But what we're doing, actually, that's what we're doing, is we're writing songs with autocomplete. It's just maybe a better autocomplete, right?
Right.
Like, that's
right.
what we've written so far. And, you know, obviously the direction to go in is in, you know, allowing for multiple passes mm-hmm. over the piece and allowing for moving up and down this kind of hierarchy. I think there's something really, really nice about following through the thought experiment. Okay, you make some chords and then from those chords you harmonize them and mm-hmm. then you try to write a melody, like that's sort of a one directional, you know, high level structure down to more fine grained structure. But then of course you really want to allow, oh, I got that chord wrong. Let's right. move back up. Let's change that chord. Let's reharmonize. You know, the noodly jazz improvisations that I do and the pop songs that I write are like basically that kind of, you know, these multi-pass models. And so, you know, I hope we can get there. It's definitely not a left to right one pass process.
One of the huge elements in music that makes it like dynamic and makes it emotional and or makes it incredible is the element of surprise, is the element of listening to something and having it fly out of the song at you and sort of hit you in the face. How does one create that or even think about creating a system that would be able to work in surprise?
So I think surprise is crucial and probably it's one of the two most interesting things at a sort of a theoretical level that you could work with in terms of art and music. And certainly it's not just music. You know, in music theory, it's usually called expectancy or expectation. And, you know, the basic idea is that the composer or the musician is pulling you along and they're going in different directions at different times. And there's actually probably two really distinct kinds of surprise in music. I just love this this idea. The first one would be something that Bach might do and is starting with one premise, so it's like making a really clear statement, and then changing directions.
Right.
And then
the premise is actually over here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, maybe in the, you know, the 19th century, you see something new happening, which is composers like Brahms, and in fact, lots of hip hop artists, starting with an unclear premise. So it's not that they started with something super clear and then changed directions. Like in Brahms, it'll be like things get started slowly. And there's this hint that this might be in 3-4, a triple meter. And then, no, wait, isn't it 4-4? And you're not sure what key it is. And you're doing lots of like movements around two or three keys. And so you're not even like, your brain is kind of struggling just to understand what's happening at all. And then as if the mist clears, you're getting that. And in hip hop, it's very like, I collect examples of a misdirection, rhythmic misdirection. Like it's been happening all over the place. But you may notice, you know, something will happen with a rhythm and some sense of a downbeat gets established. And then when the singer or the speaker, the rapper comes in, they actually show you that that was an offbeat and you're shifted, you're pulled back and forth, and false endings and all of these things. This is all, I think, having fun with unclear definition of where we are and then sort of solidifying it one direction or another. Okay, so those are sort of, you know, theoretically what's interesting about surprise. How do we get it? I think that's even more interesting. I think in one sense, this is a deep problem. This is core to music and art, and so we don't know how to solve it, and we'll throw up our hands. But I like to put on an engineer's hat from time to time and say, well, we can probably hack our way around it. And I think one way to hack around the surprise issue is to always try to have multiple threads of meaning. Some things get easier when you make them more complicated. And I think, so for, imagine that what you have are lyrics. Imagine you have lyrics and a video. Imagine you have lyrics and video and audio. That seems like, solve one of them first and then try to solve all three together. But as soon as you have these multiple things happening in parallel, you can play them against one another.
Yeah.
And I actually have a great example of this. Like I think I believe I found the simple, the simplest example. I'm laughing as I'm thinking about this, by the way. I have the simplest example of surprise, not done by me, computational surprise. And it was done by a woman named Chloe Kidden. And she wrote a paper describing how to detect "that's what she said" moments. And I, you have to leave this in, but I hesitate to say, like, it's kind of like frat boy humor. I don't really like "that's what she said." No, but like, I want to be clear that I think, you know,
it's genius. It's a moment. It's a moment of pause, right?
Yeah,
because those usually occur when a statement is said and then someone sort of brings in the non sequitur that makes you reevaluate the statement
exactly
in a new light. Yeah.
So, yeah. And, you know, it's you know, unintended, you know, sexual innuendo or something like that. So what she did was she wrote a language model-based detector that would go off with a bot and put hashtag "that's what she said" on your Twitter feed. You know? So it was funny. Right? I think it's funny.
Nice.
And it's, okay, so fine. But what's brilliant about this in my mind is that the way she solved this problem is she generated not one but two language models. And by language model, I mean, the details are in the paper. I'm going to really gloss over them. But a probabilistic model where you give it a sentence and it comes back to you and says, what's the probability that that sentence is a real sentence from your language?
Yeah.
You know, English.
Yeah.
And the kind of English we would speak on Twitter.
Right.
And so she trained one language model with text from probably the New York Times or one of these big kind of normal text databases. And then she can throw her tweet at it and it'll come back and say, you know, 0.73%, that's a legit sentence.
That's English that makes sense. Yeah.
Can you guess what the second language model was that she trained? Come on, you
IMDb
can do it.
IMDb databases is... for frat boy movies.
Close. Erotic fiction.
Oh God, of course. Isn't that great? Of course, that's perfect.
So like basically I hope in the minds of the listeners and in your mind it's just like the answer just tumbles out.
Oh, of course.
I get it.
Yes.
But let's make sure there's a detail that you might have missed. So what's the actual trigger for triggering a that's what she said? You have the sentence, we throw it at both models. Mm-hmm. So what needs to happen?
It needs to find the middle of the Venn diagram that fits, like, this is an English sentence that makes sense, and it's probably about sex in some kind of a way.
Kind of. Actually, if it's probable in both models, mm-hmm. you don't actually want to trigger on that.
Oh.
Because even in erotic fiction, sentences like, those shoes are green,
right,
are going to happen.
Right, yeah.
Right. Yes. So what you need are these weird sentences that are, for reasons that we won't talk about on the radio, more probable in erotic fiction than they would be in the New York Times. And the cool thing about that is, like, I think if you gave as like a homework assignment, I don't know what university would give this homework assignment to a bunch of grad students and say, you know, write a Twitter bot that detects that's what she said moments. You could imagine like running off in just the most wild, overthought, arcane directions, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think you can do this easily with just one model.
Right.
It's the idea of having two.
Right.
You have two spaces of meaning. You have two ideas of what the world is. And what you're doing is you're playing one against the other. And I think if we go back to music or art generation, it's this idea of saying, you know, I'm not going to break all the rules at once.
Right.
Good surprise, I think, there's always bad surprise. We're on the top of a pretty tall building here and it could fall over. And that would be surprising to me, right?
Yeah.
It's bad. No, but like the idea is like, you know, we're not going to break all the rules at once.
Right.
In painting, maybe what we're going to do is work with a different material, or maybe we're going to, God, I just already feel lost when I start talking about painting, but, you know, you might still paint dogs,
right.
But you know, they might still have four legs, but we're going to give them, you know, different fur. I don't know.
Right.
And in music, this is happening all the time. Some of the music that we think is the most revolutionary, I'm thinking of like my childhood and punk music.
Yeah.
It's still the same three chords, right?
Right.
Like these people were like moving music in a completely new direction, but they were doing it with 1-4-5 progressions, right?
Totally.
I can think of like, okay, there are the Frank Zappas of this world that actually can manage to like break 9 rules at once and you still come out on the other side not too wounded from listening to
it. Right, totally. But there's only one Frank Zappa,
right,
and punk
true.
Is a whole genre, right?
So I love this idea of saying, you know, if the medium provides you multiple channels, right?
Yeah.
Multiple, I don't even know what the right word is, multiple modes, multiple channels of meaning, then you can always play one against the other.
You need sort of a clarification.
Yeah, which is why I think it may be easier to be working across modalities to say, hey, I'm going to work with text and video and audio all at once.
Yeah.
Because then it gives you more kind of levers to pull in terms of like kind of doing the normal thing in one, in you know, one or two of these areas and then like doing something surprising
in
the third.
Do you think this would be an interesting area for exploring adversarial models if you're the question that you're trying to answer is like, it's like this and it's sort of not like this?
Let's flip that on its head with mm-hmm. adversarial models. One way to look at this is if we could train an extremely good adversarial model mm-hmm. for art generation, mm-hmm. I claim that that model would have learned a whole lot about how these different sort of channels of meaning or modes of meaning fit together, mm-hmm. right? You know, the adversary might say something like, that's not a very good punk song.
Right.
And the gradient that flows back is, oh, I used too many funny chords. I should have stayed with 1-4-5. Right,
right. Right.
The adversarial issue is like, I think one of the other big ideas, which is the way I put it is, you know, everyone needs a critic.
Right, right. An editor.
I think the adversary is just a special case of a critic where this adversary happens to be. I don't know how much you know about adversarial learning or your listeners, but it's actually not an adversary.
Mm-hmm.
It's your friend, mm-hmm. and it's your counterfeit friend, your counterfeiting
right.
friend. Like, hey, I'm trying to counterfeit something. Here's my first try. And this so-called adversary is like, no, that's not real.
Right.
If it were a real adversary, that's all it would say. It also says, oh, here's some hints on how to do better.
Right,
so it's
exactly.
like really a pretty
this is
nice.
What it, this is what it should be.
Pretty
more
nice
like
adversary,
yeah,
right?
Right.
But I think more generally, having that critic can extend to in reinforcement learning, you have this idea of reward. Mm-hmm. So the simplest thing you might think of is learning to play backgammon. And so, you know, you're making these moves and you move yourself in a poor direction, you lose the game and you get back negative reward. I think we can talk about, you know, having interesting and new models of reward that look like critics. Mm-hmm. That might start as critics that we've used music knowledge to code. Mm-hmm. You know, say we're going to just put in as much sort of prior knowledge as we can into that critic. And then using reinforcement learning, train up a model that can at least make that critic happy. And then, and this is where I think the field would actually explode in a really wonderful way. If we can get, you know, let's say we get like 50 music generators or whatever, poetry generators. Nobody really reads poetry. So, you know, we've got like hundreds of people reading the poetry. I'm sorry. I like poetry.
Tens of people reading
exactly
poetry.
Right. There are dozens of us. And if you can get this generated music, from my example, out to listeners and to other musicians, right? I can't stress this enough. If we can get enough signal and use it in a reinforcement learning framework to improve, that's game changing.
Right.
Right. Yeah. That's this understanding, you know, if this becomes a music recommendation problem, which is something I worked on for a long time. And now, you know, you're going to look at what your users actually listen to and propagate that back to your models as a reward signal. And, you know, you don't have to do this over the span of like 20 milliseconds. You can like improve something every week and get a little bit better. Right. But I think that provides us with a very enticing way to kind of move up the quality, move up the sort of this really hard hill to climb of like getting better and better. Like, you know, like the best we can hope to do, I think, is we're not talking about Picasso or the Beatles here. We're talking about like generating stuff that's maybe as fun as 5 minutes of Reddit, right? Like that, like, but think of how cool that is already.
Yeah.
Like if you can use machine learning to generate stuff that's as fun as reading Reddit for 5 minutes or, you know, whatever your other favorite time waster is, I think we can do, like, we can actually provide more meaningful content and like a much more enriching experience by having personalized generated content.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's there for you every day. And if it's really there for you every day, then we've changed the world. Even if it's like, I mean, Reddit changed the world.
Right.
You know,
right? Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that.
One of the things that I think about a lot of when that is sort of wrapped up in experiencing music is the performative aspect of it. Where do you think that fits in at all in generative music?
Music performance has to, right? There's a real puzzle in terms of, all right, let me back up. So music performance, let me back up one more time because it's so important. So let's get this right. So you're asking about the importance of music performance in generative music. And I think if I had to assign percentages, probably at least in the last 40 years, the performance aspect was well over the 50% line, and the scoring aspect is much less.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real challenge to understand how to get, you know, computational models to perform adequately. There's been some great people working in this area. I think Gil Weinberg from Georgia Tech has done a really great job of getting his marimba playing robots to be able to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's focused on a lot of really important aspects of this. One is, you know, musicians look around and they're in the moment playing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we as viewers or listeners, I think we underestimate the importance of that. I used to torture people by, I used to have this really cool reproducing grand piano when I was at the University of Montreal.
Awesome.
And a Bösendorfer, big monster of a piano.
That's
and,
so cool.
You know, I bring a pianist in and have them record a piece and then take the score and, you know, you can play their performance back.
Right.
They're not sitting there. Right?
Right.
But then you're comparing apples to apples if you have a computer play the piano. So you had a person play the piano and you have a computer play the piano and you play the same score and it's the same notes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's the same notes.
Right,
okay?
Right.
All that's different is the performer is, you know, playing notes a little earlier, a little later, a little louder, a little softer. Let's factor out pedaling, but pedaling could be there too.
Right.
And like from an information perspective, right, there's not an immense amount of information provided. It, like the MIDI file that stores the performance is about the same size.
Yeah.
Things are just happening later or earlier. But the difference in how these pieces sound is not like, oh, the human performance is whatever, 5% more listenable. It's right. just like night and day.
Right. Yeah.
It's like,
right.
I can't listen to this computer playing this piece of
right,
music.
Yeah,
it's
right.
so bad. I can't right. stand it. Yes. And like that, you know, college level, decent conservatory pianist just
right.
moved me. Right.
Right.
Now these are pieces of music. These are like etudes and things like that, that are written for the performance, you
right.
know, to be performed,
yeah.
but still there's something there. And like, oh, so that's one thing. So A, it's hard. B, it matters. And C, it seems to be about the musician interacting with the environment mm-hmm. dynamically and mm-hmm. actually changing what they're doing based upon what they're hearing. They're really closing the perceptual feedback loop. And part of that feedback, if you're playing in a group, is understanding where the other musicians are.
Right.
So it's a long-winded way of saying it matters. Done work on it in the past. And in terms of Magenta, we're doing something that I hope is the right first step, sort of throwing up our hands and saying, I don't really know how to solve this.
Yeah.
But we're working on building really robust, great, real-time tools.
Mm.
Like, a win for me is that you can train your Magenta generation model and that you have a really solid, you know, Ableton Live plugin that mm-hmm. allows you to work with it right away. And it's just there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At least by doing that, we provide ourselves the ability to have, you know, even bad, broken models able to perform with others.
Mm.
And then that opens up the loop for us to understand what they're doing right and doing wrong. So that's a kind of a tool building approach to things. We're going to sort of build some tools and then see where to go from there. Because I don't really know how to solve that problem.
Doug Eck of the Magenta Project at Google. I'm just fascinated by these questions of creativity and machine learning.
It's such really cool stuff. Yeah, really fun.
Definitely. Well, that's it for us this week. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Ryan Adams.
Tune in next episode.